This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. We have some time for questions from the audience. While the ushers collect them, let me begin by asking this, which I'm sure everyone is wondering. How does a young man from tiny Peterborough, New Hampshire, become a leader in reducing violence in a major metropolitan area like Chicago?
Well, thanks, Phil. Thanks again. I think I touched on this briefly in the talk when I acknowledged insufficiently the people right here in this room who helped me to become that person, who insisted that I think more widely, more broadly about what I could do. I cut my teeth in this work in a conflict zone in Belfast, and in work that I did in Belfast and in Dublin around post-conflict reconciliation, bringing together former combatants, holding public forums that tried to envision a peaceful shared future for their communities. So I think those experiences had a lot to do with helping me for those kinds of really intense encounters. But also work I did stateside as a community organizer, as a workshop leader for nonviolent activists. I think leading those efforts also prepared me to do that, but this work was also personal for me. I'm the first in my family to attend college, and I had adults around me who supported me in trying that and in envisioning a kind of active, engaged future for myself.
And I think one other thing we'd like to know is, how do you actually do the work? It seems like an almost impossible undertaking to get from here to there. How do you really work in the program?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm glad to answer it because it was touched on only briefly in my remarks earlier. We start with developing relationships in the communities where we work. It has to start there. Without a basic trust, it's not possible to do good community partnership or youth development work. But to get right to the specifics, we design a curriculum that is entirely youth-driven and built around open-ended questions that ask young people to come forward and to start to share their experiences with one another, to feel that they belong, to develop trust with one another, and to develop trust with the teacher. And that relationship between those young people and that adult is a critical one, because what it does is it offers to this group of young people a reliable, steady, caring adult presence, which many of these young people have in their own lives, but those adults are extremely strained and stressed and are dealing with a lot of the same issues that the young people are dealing with. So another critical component of our work is to train and support those teachers. We don't train them in some method that's foreign to them and show up as though we have all the answers and if you just do it our way, everything will be fine. We try to show up a lot more respectfully than that and recognize the work that they've been doing, build from their strengths and their areas of expertise, their passions. And then there's the curriculum, there's supporting the teachers, and then there's just surrounding the program with whatever resources are needed and making sure that it can operate. I think about it a lot as running, blocking, and just making sure that that space is protected, because fundamentally, when given the chance, young people do this work for themselves and for one another, and they do it really well when they have a good chance. And what they need to have a chance at it is a space. And so we try to look after that space for them and make sure that it's available to them.
Here's a question from the audience. If you had to convey one skill or technique to apply to nonviolent communication, what would it be? What have you used the most?
I think silence is really important. And that's not just because I couldn't think of the answer. No, but I think in many, it's served me well, not just in Chicago, but in other settings. The work is not simple. And this process of discovery, this hard work that young people are undertaking in Chicago, in our programs, it's not, it doesn't come naturally, it doesn't come easily, and people need time. And I think a lot of times we shortcut people's learning, not just in programs like these, but all over this great country. We're not willing to wait just another second to give someone a chance to think past, did I shut the oven off? Those are interesting shoes. I wonder where she got those. People need a minute, and people especially need a minute if they got shot at the day before, or if they came to school still feeling a little bit hungry. And certainly if you're asking people to talk about their most deeply held passions and they're not used to being asked that, or you're asking people to talk about how they would like to change their neighborhood and they're not used to thinking that they could be that powerful, silence is a really valuable tool.
A couple of questions are sort of related. How can communities in a rural area like this bring the Civic Leadership Foundation program into a place like rural New Hampshire?
I appreciate the question. What we do at Civic Leadership Foundation is right now really solely focused on Chicago. It doesn't mean we don't have ambitions to bring it elsewhere, but if you have that impulse, which is really, it's the one to have right now, I would encourage you to think about what's happening right around here that is really trying to do the same thing, to engage young people, to bring them in, and to inspire them to think about their future in robust ways. And that work is critical across New Hampshire and across the country. If you are moved to address the need in a city like Chicago, where, believe me, the need is so great, I would encourage you to start some reading. And I think a first step that you can make in being helpful to youth of color in Chicago would be to go through your own search of figuring out how it is that you personally can be helpful. So I don't think that that's really for me to say. I would love to talk to you more about the work that I've done, the people I know, the relationships that I'm in Chicago, and to tell you more about Civic Leadership Foundation. But I would encourage you to think about your talents and what it is, the voice that you have to offer to young people being relevant right in your neighborhood, as well as across the country, because I actually do think that that kind of support is critical at this time. Chicago hasn't been able to figure it out yet on their own. We have not been able to do that. So thanks for that question, that compassionate question, whoever it was.
Okay. All you have to do is look around to see that this is a little bit different community than Chicago. So what would you say to someone who is in our community about why they should care about gang violence in a place like Chicago when we don't experience that sort of thing here?
Yeah. Well, a couple things. I'll answer the question in earnest after pushing back a little bit on the premise. And the premise in the question is that we don't experience any of this here. And it's not true. Violence is not just a Chicago issue. Poverty is not just a Chicago issue. Inspiring young people to be involved and to think in big ways about their future is not a Chicago issue. But I won't stop at just arguing with the question. I think that those Americans who were watching Judgment at Nuremberg and having their moral reckoning with the Holocaust were caught off guard to suddenly have imagery of their own country's brutality, the law enforcement of their own country's brutality, that nudged them off of whatever couch cushion allowed them to be comfortable with Jim Crow. And, if this talk didn't do it for you, and maybe it didn't, and that's fine, keep reading, keep asking questions about what life is like for a young person, not just in Chicago, but in Baltimore, in Detroit, in New Orleans, in Los Angeles.
Are there policies at the federal level that can contribute to solving these problems, or is this a sort of a grassroots movement?
Well, a problem of this magnitude and interconnected problems of this magnitude can't be one or the other. So I think certainly we have to be involved at a community level, and I think we have to look to leadership in the country to craft strategy and to be visionary about how we overcome some of these challenges. And some of us are experiencing a lack of optimism at the moment with regard to the federal government. But that's not a reason to stop pushing and to stop expecting common sense gun reform. It's not a reason to start to expect, to continue to expect more equitable funding formulas for education systems across the country. It's not a reason not to expect that we start to tend to young people's mental health as dutifully as we tend to their infractions and their mistakes. So I think
one more quick one right now, please, Adar. What do you think the impact of the privatization of incarceration systems has been on recidivism?
The impact on recidivism is the question?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's not a winning idea to privatize prisons. Morally, to start. Practically, it's not good for safety, and we should be thinking right now in this country, a country that incarcerates more people than any other country in the world, about how to dismantle and address our problem of mass incarceration, rather than thinking about how to, open it up to the free market and essentially incentivize incarceration. That's, if we're interested in being a democracy, and if we're interested in opportunity for all, and if we're interested in really recovering from the great trauma around racial injustice that this country has experienced, then we have to be thinking differently than the privatization of prisons.
Thank you again, Adar, for sharing your time and expertise and experience with us today. You've been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website at www.monadnocklyceum.org or stay up to date by liking us on Facebook. The program next Sunday, July 29, will feature Kevin Esvelt from MIT discussing the moral obligations of technology. And thank you again, Adar, for a wonderful talk this morning. Now, please join us in the parish hall and enjoy some refreshments, which have been most generously provided by the Cooper's Hill Public House in Peterborough. If you asked a question, and we have dozens of them that weren't answered this morning, please feel free to ask of Adar during the reception. Adar's book will also be available for purchase and signing. And I'd like to take this opportunity to thank Roger Swain for today's beautiful flowers. Thank you so much for coming today and making possible this lively dialogue. We'd like to hear from you about your experience today, and we encourage you to fill out the green card and add your name to our email list. Thank you very much.